The following is a production of University Laboratory High School in Urbana and Illinois Public Media.
I spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief, Lord. Somebody, can anybody find me?
Because I think people should be able to marry whoever they want to as long as they're happy and they're not hurting anybody else and they're minding their own business.
I met Allie, who's my partner. She definitely sparked something in me the first time I saw her. I walked past her in the sculpture studio. Like, I could feel my heart just like pitter-pat, you know? And she can still do that to me.
I think I knew I was a little bit different in high school, but it was still thinking of marrying and having children. There was no one to talk to if I had any other kind of feelings. There was no place to go, church or school, or you didn't talk to other people because you thought they wouldn't understand, your friends, or you just didn't know. So you kept that all to yourself until you found someone, and then you thought you two were the only ones who were like that. Everybody else wasn't like that.
I think you should just be allowed to marry who you want to marry. Life is too hard and too short, and I just think you have to be with whoever makes you happy.
Marriage has long been celebrated as a formal commitment between two people who wish to create a life together. When recognized by the law, marriage bestows upon the couple certain legal rights and responsibilities. But interracial and same-sex couples wishing to marry in the United States have long faced legal barriers and cultural stigma. However, perceptions and practices of marriage are changing. University Laboratory High School students interviewed legal experts, officiants, activists, and couples from many backgrounds about their relationships and the institution of marriage. We proudly present their stories in The Pursuit of Happiness, The Struggle for Marriage Equality from the 1950s to 2015. I'm Nafisa Sayed.
I'm Emma Ondrejcova.
And I'm Simone Gore.
Can't really stand on my feet.
Take a look, take a look in the mirror and cry.
What about your daddy? I have spent all my years in believing you, but I just can't get no relief, Lord. Somebody. Can anybody find me?
American history has been marked by racial oppression. Since well before the country's founding, there have been anti-miscegenation laws preventing interracial, intercultural, and interfaith marriage. Such laws assume that there is inherent danger in allowing people from different categories to mix. In the United States, anti-miscegenation has been most commonly used to mean statutes banning marriage between African Americans and whites. The first of these laws was enacted in 1664, when Maryland prohibited marriage between black people who were enslaved and the white people who owned them. Even after slavery was abolished, the Supreme Court ruled in 1883 that anti-miscegenation laws were constitutional. However, states had the power to legislate marriage, and thus marriage laws varied greatly from state to state. The state of Illinois had anti-miscegenation laws from 1829 to 1874. While some states began repealing laws against interracial marriage as early as the mid-19th century, in other states, especially in but not limited to the South, anti-miscegenation laws remained popular, and they were buttressed by the introduction of Jim Crow laws in the late 19th and 20th centuries. Several of our interviewees recalled growing up in communities that were segregated by race. Harold Alston spent part of his childhood in Alexandria, Louisiana, in the 1950s and 60s.
Very segregated community. Very segregated. I remember getting kicked out of the library when I was like 9 years old. Just weren't welcome in the public library. And I remember getting on the bus when I was like 5 or 6 and having to walk and sit in the back of the bus. There's a few painful memories there. Very painful.
Racial segregation also impacted communities in the North, as Tom Moore, who is also black, recalls from his childhood in the 1950s.
I remember when I was 12 years old, my mom said to me, "Hey, Tom, come on, let's go downtown Pittsburgh, and we'll have a birthday celebration, birthday lunch." I said, "Great." So she said, "You can go anywhere you want." And so I picked a restaurant to go into, and she said, "Oh, but we can't go there because they won't serve us." That was a shock to me. I didn't know what that meant.
Nancy Yeagle, who is white, is married to Harold Alston and grew up in Farmer City, Illinois in the 1960s.
We had sundown laws, and they weren't open. They were probably written down somewhere, but everybody just sort of knew that. I can almost remember hearing that phrase, "You better get out of town before sundown."
Northern black families were always worried about their men, what would befall them when they're out of their sight. That was always present somehow when you'd leave the house and my grandmother would say, you be careful, watch yourself and behave. There's real sincerity about watch what you're doing, you be careful because I can't protect you, and you behave because you didn't have to misbehave to get yourself in trouble. So you just be careful.
With the end of World War II and the return of troops from overseas, Americans became increasingly aware of the contradictions between the United States' commitment to democracy abroad and entrenched racial segregation at home. The late 1940s and early 1950s witnessed a wave of repeals of anti-miscegenation laws, starting with California in 1948. But attitudes towards interracial marriage were much slower to change. A 1958 Gallup poll found that only 4% of Americans supported it. As a child in Farmer City, Nancy Yeagle encountered prejudicial attitudes about interracial marriage.
There was one family that I grew up with. The sister was in my class, and there was an interracial relationship and an interracial child from that couple. And she was very looked askance at. There was a lot of tisk-tisk and poor child, you know, and she's so different, and she doesn't know where she belongs.
Becky Lewis currently lives in Champaign, but grew up in Kentucky and Tennessee towns. She is in an interracial marriage with her husband of 15 years and describes her family's opposition to their union.
Well, I always knew that they were against it and not really actually the marriage. I hate to say racist, but I think they were racist in a lot of ways. And I think it was just because they didn't know. They didn't grow up around anyone of color. It was something that they just didn't understand. And I remember a girl on my softball team that had called the house, and they were like, what is she calling here for? She doesn't need to be calling here.
Tom Moore encountered similar attitudes during his childhood.
Of course, we had in our family people who were doing cross-racial dating, and there was always comments about that. I don't know why he's dating that woman. I don't know what he sees in her. She's nothing special. Certainly there has to be a black woman around, a colored woman around, that would be more attractive to him. So there were those kinds of conversations. I don't know who he thinks he is. Well, why is it that when black men get to be movie stars or musicians, first thing they do is marry a white woman?
This opposition to marriage was especially linked to the deeply rooted prohibition of black men being involved with white women, as Howard Milton, who is black, observes.
The real taboo here really was black male, white female in this country. That was the taboo.
Diana Black, who is white, grew up during the 1970s and 80s.
My town of Toledo, Illinois, didn't have any Asian people, Indian people, Jewish people, black people. It didn't have anybody but white people. I was a little bit unusual because I had brown hair. Just kidding. But, you know, it was a very, very homogenous community. So I wasn't exposed to anything other than farm boys that they would approve of at that point. When I left for college, I remember my grandmother telling me, you better not marry a black man. And I thought, okay, I don't know why I would do that, but whatever.
We learn to read and write. A child is black, a child is white. The whole world looks upon a sight, a beautiful sight.
In the 1950s and 60s, the Civil Rights Movement pushed for the desegregation of schools, neighborhoods, and workplaces, and in this way helped to create circumstances where people from different racial backgrounds could interact. In 1954, the Supreme Court mandated in Brown versus the Board of Education that the desegregation of public schools should be implemented with all deliberate speed. However, desegregation both in schools and at informal social levels occurred slowly in many communities. Nancy Yeagle recalls the awkwardness of a public playdate with children of another race.
My parents were, I think, different from the average person in Farmer City. They both somehow were aware that they should introduce us to other groups besides the demographic in Farmer City. And we actually spent time going to Peoria, to a very low-income neighborhood, to meet some other children who were black and poor and grew up in the city. And we had to figure out a way to spend the afternoon with these girls. And we had nothing in common with them other than being little girls. The girls actually came to Farmer City once, and we sat out on the park and talked for a long time. And I'm very sure that anyone who saw us thought that we were very, very, very strange, and we got a lot of stares. Because, you know, black kids from Peoria didn't come to Farmer City to spend the afternoon.
Martha Moore, who is white, grew up in Peekskill, New York, from the 1950s to 1970s.
Was your school and the school that your mother taught in, was it integrated largely or no?
Oh, yeah. I really wouldn't have been able to tell you except that we found a picture of my fifth or sixth grade, and I looked and I said, oh, gee, well, we looked like it was about a third black, mostly working class. New York was not segregated at that point.
But Brown versus Board of Education also led to unexpected consequences, as Martha's husband Tom recalls.
I grew up in a neighborhood that by the time I remember being in it was a pretty integrated neighborhood. But by the time I graduated from high school, it was not. The neighborhood was a victim, I think, of that period of time, which was called redlining. Real estate people would come through the neighborhood and say to white neighbors, do you know that this neighborhood's getting ready to change and there's black people going to be living next door? They threw some kind of panic into the community and people moved out.
White people.
Resistance to racial integration marked the history of many communities. Again, Becky Lewis.
When we lived in Jackson, Tennessee, when I remember my parents talking about we ended up moving, and one of the reasons was because of the busing. They were busing and integrating the schools. And I look back now and I'm like, that was in the middle 70s. And it was at the time when there was no integration of schools and that they were starting that.
Despite such resistance, bolstered by the civil rights movement, laws banning interracial marriage began to fall. In 1957, the states were equally divided between the number that did and did not outlaw interracial marriage. By 1965, only 17 states still had anti-miscegenation laws. However, they formed a contiguous bloc in the southeastern part of the country, from Texas to Delaware. Mildred and Richard Loving, an interracial couple from rural Virginia, decided to challenge these laws. The Lovings had married in 1958 in the District of Columbia. Upon returning home to Virginia, they were arrested and charged with violating the state's Racial Integrity Act. The law required the Lovings to leave Virginia. After several years of exile, the Lovings returned to Virginia in the mid-1960s, and with the help of lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union, filed a lawsuit that eventually was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. Attorney Bernard Cohen argued before the court on behalf of the Lovings.
The Lovings have the right to go to sleep at night, knowing that should they not awake in the morning, their children would have the right to inherit from them under intestacy. They have the right to be secure in knowing that if they go to sleep and do not wake in the morning, that one of them, a survivor of them, has the right to Social Security benefits. All of these are denied to them, and they will not be denied to them if the whole miscegenous, anti-miscegenation scheme of Virginia, sections 20 through 50 through 20-60, are found unconstitutional.
In 1967, in its decision on Loving versus Virginia, the court ruled that all remaining anti-miscegenation laws were unconstitutional. Although interracial marriage was now legal everywhere in the United States, it was still not widely accepted. Howard and Barclay Milton, an interracial couple, started dating when they were high school students in the late 1980s. Howard, who is black, recalls how their relationship was seen in their small Kansas town.
I think socially, from a community standpoint, there was some chatter, and my mom being really concerned that I had this friend, this girlfriend, that was white.
As a couple, Howard and Barclay faced opposition from Barclay's parents.
I went to their house to say, hey, to her parents, we're dating, and her dad, who had been known to sort of have a temper, I remember him saying, Howard, I don't think that's going to work. There was a six-month period in there that we were dating, I guess, and nobody knew.
So that was a little harder because certainly you want your parents to accept and be behind you in everything you do, which they were. My parents totally have been. That just was because of how they were raised, where they were raised.
Diana Black, who is white, describes how people reacted when she first started dating Joe Omo Sagie, a native of Nigeria, in 2000.
Well, one of my Catholic friends said, I was going to hell now because black people were the mark of Ham. Some of my friends said, wow, you found happiness, that's great, go with it. My mother's brother, he was very against our relationship at first. And he said, you know, this is going to be difficult. But I went back and talked to him one day, this was before we got married. And he said to me, well, at the end of the day, you're the one who has to wake up in the morning, either alone or next to somebody. I wake up alone. And that made me understand that he was going to love me through whatever choice that I made, although he may not agree with that choice.
Long after interracial marriage had become legal across the nation, struggles for acceptance continued. In 1973, a Gallup poll showed that 29% of people approved of interracial marriage, up 25% from just a little over a decade earlier. In 1990, 2.9% of marriages in the U.S. were interracial. By 2010, the figure was up to 18%. However, it was only in 1998 and 2000 that South Carolina and Alabama officially removed their anti-miscegenation laws from state law codes, despite the 1967 Supreme Court ruling making the laws unconstitutional. For many interracial couples, deciding to reveal their relationship to unapproving family members was hard, for fear that family ties or the romantic relationship would be damaged. In the 1970s, Martha Moore faced harsh disapproval from her brother.
My oldest brother, on my wedding day, sent a telegram saying, well, I would no longer be part of his family. He just died in February and never really was reconciled in 44 years.
In the late 1990s, Casey George Jackson was so worried about her family's reaction to her relationship that she took this risk over email.
I told my parents I wanted to tell them by phone and I couldn't do it. I got really nervous, so I ended up sending them an email. My father sent me an email back that had some awful things in it, things that you don't want to hear from anybody, let alone your parents, that I had disappointed them and let them down and embarrassed them, and that I needed to end the relationship and that he would never be allowed in our house. I learned that my mom had been unable to get out of bed for 2 days because she was in shock about this. We would start to have conversations later that didn't include or acknowledge James's existence, but there was this deep anger from my father and then this shocked response from my mother.
In 2000, Becky Lewis felt anguish at the prospect of telling her parents that her fiancé was black.
I had to tell my parents. I mean, I was getting married in April, and I knew how they would feel, and I left Florida without telling them. And I remember in the airport, I cried from the time I left Tampa to the time I landed in Indianapolis, bawling. I remember having a long conversation with my husband now that and crying and crying and crying, and he's like, maybe we shouldn't be together. And I was like, but that's not right, because it's only because color of your skin. So I knew how my parents would feel. I think we'd even had a conversation at one point that my mom had said she would disown me. And I said, oh, you couldn't stop loving me. And she said, it wouldn't be that I don't love you. It's that you never existed. I'm not living my life to make somebody else happy. And that was hard for me to come to that kind of mindset, because I don't want to disappoint people. And it just came to the point where I have to do what makes me happy, and he made me happy, and it didn't matter to me that he wasn't the same color.
Despite often painful confrontations with family, interracial couples still got married, and the weddings themselves sometimes revealed further racial prejudices and tensions. Diana Black married Joe Omo Osagie in the 2000s.
We chose to get married there on the lawn. We had this beautiful house. During our wedding, our neighbor, who was a former Chicago cop and of Polish ethnicity, put up a fence in between our properties, as he told me, to keep the niggers from raping his wife. During our entire ceremony, he and the neighbors back behind our property shot guns into the air.
For interracial couples, having children sometimes helps to heal broken family ties and can be a way to reconnect with estranged loved ones. Again, Becky Lewis.
Actually, when this all came out that I was in interracial marriage, I was actually worried to tell my grandmother, who I was really close to, and I did not tell her. My son was born. So at that time, I'd been married 5 years, and my grandmother didn't know that. My son was born either, and I remember her calling me on my birthday to tell me happy birthday, and I was holding my son. I ended up writing a letter to my grandmother just saying that I didn't want to tell you because I was worried that I would lose you, but because I can't tell you anyway and I can't share with you, I've already lost you. My grandmother ended up calling me and telling me, if you love him, we love him, and that's God's way. He doesn't care what color you are. That was something I learned from my grandmother really quick, that if you love somebody, I love them. And a few weeks later, we were in the car on the way to my grandmother's.
Casey George Jackson had a similar experience when her son was born in the mid-2000s.
We called them and said, we're going to the hospital. And by 6 a.m. that morning, James's parents and my parents were at the hospital. So they were there for their grandson to be born, and it was just kind of a nice thing. Thinking so many years prior to that my father wasn't even going to acknowledge that James existed, or had called him a thug and called him all these other names and called me a lot of names, that, like, here they are in the waiting room waiting for their grandson to be born. It was a special moment. After Nate was born, the four of them went out and had a fancy dinner together to celebrate. And so that was just kind of nice that that happened, because you asked me to project that that was going to happen years ago. I didn't think that there was any way.
While children in interracial families can help to heal relationships with relatives, public reactions to interracial families also expose underlying racism and thinly veiled opposition to interracial marriage. Joe Omoosagie and Diana Black still feel the pressures of such attitudes in their daily lives today.
One of the things that we have learned, because we like to travel, if we're South, it's better for her to go in first.
By myself.
By herself, without the kids. And she goes and negotiates the rooms or whatever, because unfortunately, there are still some people that have those attitudes.
And even in this town, I didn't realize the privilege of being a white woman. I had absolutely no idea what that privilege was until I lost it. I often don't wear a wedding ring. We live on a farm. I work at Vet Med. And when I would take my youngest when he was a baby, this is when I really started noticing it. I would go places without a wedding ring with a black baby. And people automatically make an assumption. You're not married, you're on welfare, and you're not educated. Every time. Mm-hmm. Every single time.
Likewise, strangers often assume Casey George Jackson and her husband are not married.
On a day-to-day basis, I feel like our relationship is like other relationships, like a normal, quote-unquote. But then there's certain reminders, like if we go out to a restaurant, and I laugh at this because I know of other interracial couples who have this experience. If we go out to a restaurant, the waiters often treat us as if we're not together. Like they'll bring us separate bills automatically. And when we say we're together, some of them seem surprised. I even have an interracial couple. The woman's the friend of mine that they go out with their kids. So it's a family of four, and they still get treated differently at the restaurants, and people don't believe them that they're together.
In situations like these, interracial marriage is not always accepted, even today. Yet there are signs that interracial marriage is becoming customary and acceptance is growing. Howard and Barclay Milton recall viewing a 2013 Cheerios commercial featuring an interracial family.
We advance quicker technically than we do socially. So you wouldn't think that in our society that a Cheerios commercial having an interracial family would be no big deal. But apparently nationally it is. But for us, or for me, my issue was, wow, when Barclay and I first got together, there was nothing like this on TV. And not just out of happenstance, they're socially, we weren't ready. They weren't making those things. It wasn't socially acceptable. I said it. It wasn't.
You know, with interracial friends. I don't even think they would show black and white friend hanging out or anything like that.
For Joe Omoosagie, growing acceptance has meant better relationships with his in-laws.
Anna's mother had a really difficult time. She wouldn't make eye contact with me. She wouldn't talk to me. She wouldn't do anything that showed that she cared about. However, she has made the biggest move from where we started in 2000. And where we are in 2014. Her odyssey, her journey has been great. On our wedding, she cried all through the ceremony. And today, she asks about me. She talks about me. She sometimes even tries to talk to me. She has made the biggest move of all. And I appreciate it. I appreciate her.
Although the civil rights movement helped people become more open-minded about racial integration and interracial marriage, for much of the 20th century, there was little mainstream discussion of homosexuality in the United States, and little hope that romantic relationships or marriage would be openly acknowledged or accepted. Kathy Spiegel grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, and recalls the atmosphere around homosexuality.
In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the word lesbian was not a word that you ever heard. You didn't hear about the word homosexual. I went to a Catholic high school, and the nuns talked about special friendships, and I found out later that that's what they were referring to, but it never occurred to me to do anything other than what everybody else did, and that was to date boys, to eventually get married and have kids.
Janice Himes and Becky Sheridan, who have been together for more than 40 years, experienced a similar lack of discussion and witnessed homophobic attitudes as high school students in the 1960s.
The students would talk about one particular fellow that they thought was queer, and that was the word they used, was queer. And then on Thursdays, they called it Queers Day. Can you believe it? You wanted to make sure you didn't wear a certain kind of clothes because that would indicate you were a queer. So it was a type of bullying, yeah, most definitely. But as far as I knew, there was nobody that I was aware of.
Yeah, the same thing here. Girl or boy, wasn't aware that anybody else might be. And we also had, I think it was Thursday, don't wear yellow on Thursday or something like that, yeah, because that was Queers Day. And I didn't even know exactly what a queer was. But it was just something that was always said and not talked about. So, and I'm sure there were others besides myself.
For much of the 20th century, the homophobic teachings of many organized religions contributed to the oppression of lesbians, gay men, and bisexuals. Leah Roberts-Mosser, who is currently a minister at the United Church of Christ on the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana campus, was presented with limited perspectives on homosexuality as a young member of her religious community in Indiana.
My church camp experience, which was very formative growing up, was pretty conservative, and they had a very clear picture of what was appropriate in terms of human sexuality and sexual orientation. My parents had friends who were gay. They knew folks who were gay. But these folks from church camp were such a strong influence on me that I very clearly thought that I should be loving the sinner and hating the sin.
Given these attitudes, teenagers growing up in mid-century America who suspected they might not be straight had no choice but to try to deny those thoughts. During the 1950s and 60s, Tim Temple struggled with his sexuality throughout his childhood and adolescence in Muscatine, Iowa.
I actually kind of knew that I had that leaning way back as early as 4 years old. It just never did seem to go away. When I was in high school, I started going to this fundamentalist Bible church because I'd heard that if I gave my life to Jesus, that I could be saved and that that would prevent me from being homosexual. I began to kind of see through that, and I realized that it wasn't going to make a difference for me, but I also became very disillusioned about being gay and the fact that I didn't know if I wanted to continue living or not. I mean, it got to that point in high school that I kind of wanted to end my life over the whole gay thing.
Bob Rowe notes the lack of gay representation in the media and popular culture when he was a teenager in Bourbonnais, Illinois.
Born in 1962, graduated high school in 1981. And I think the hardest part was, which I think is really amazing today, I had no role models. There was no public figure that you knew of that was gay. I mean, you watched TV and there was absolutely nothing. I mean, you could see somebody like Liberace or Paul Lynde was kind of flamboyant, but they weren't even gay. They were just flamboyant. So there was no role models and no one ever discussed it. I mean, basically the term gay was never even used. I mean, you were using terms like queer and faggot. So there was no positive reaffirmation to saying that you're okay. So it was like one of those things you kind of had to figure out on your own. And in retrospect, I think that made me a stronger person having to do that.
Ramona Oswald, who spent her adolescence in Pennsylvania, recalls her mother's reaction to her sexuality.
I didn't actually come out, and my mom found a note that my girlfriend passed to me and that I had. And it was some kind of romantic note. We were hanging out one day, and she sort of stormed into the room, and we're actually smoking pot in my bedroom, and she didn't even notice that we were doing it because she was so angry and so upset. And she stormed in and she said, "I'm waiting for your sister to come home from school, and then I'm telling her that I'm leaving, but I'm leaving. You are so disgusting. I cannot live in the same house as you." And she left for a year and moved home with her parents and left us to tell my dad when he got home from work that mom was gone.
Leslie Miller, who grew up in Falkirk, Scotland, characterizes the problems and struggles of revealing one's sexuality to family or friends.
The issue of coming out, I would imagine this is for everyone who's ever had to come out, is what do I risk losing by telling somebody this? And at that time, I was not sure that people would understand how I felt, because these were issues that people were saying, you need to be changed if you are this way. This is wrong, either in the eyes of God or the law. And therefore, to trust that somebody loved you enough to not turn away from you was a big step. And in some ways, carrying that burden yourself was easier than losing your family or your friends or whomever you might tell.
Beginning in the 1960s, various minority groups, following the example of African Americans, began fighting for their rights. And in 1969, issues surrounding homosexual, bisexual, and transgender individuals became more visible following media coverage of the Stonewall riots, protests in response to repeated police raids at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City. Jerry Cardin heard about the riots as a teenager in Iowa.
I knew that there was some sort of a gay life in larger cities. I just didn't really have a good sense of what that was about. I remembered hearing a little bit about the news of the Stonewall riots, and I thought, oh, I think those are my people. I combed that for any information about the Stonewall riots just to feel like I had some sort of a connection to what was going on. But still, that seemed so foreign from my life. And I don't know that I was even beginning to imagine that I could have moved to New York City where that happened or any place else. I think in the back of my mind was, if I do end up determining that, in fact, I am gay, that's just one of those things that I probably will have to hide. And even back then, I don't think I was aware that there were a lot of men that felt they were either gay or bisexual that got married. You know, it wasn't until many years later, after I came out, that I realized, oh my God, there's a whole bunch of people that had these feelings.
After Stonewall, visibility for gays and lesbians continued to grow. The 1960s and 70s were a period of widespread experimentation as the counterculture movement challenged many conventional boundaries. The first gay pride parades, spirited colorful demonstrations, took place in 1970 to celebrate the first anniversary of the Stonewall riots. In 1973, Sylvia Rivera spoke at Christopher Street Liberation Day, an annual celebration of the riots.
I have been beaten. I have had my nose broken. I have been thrown in jail. I have lost my job. I have lost my apartment for gay liberation. And you all treat me this way?
Following a long history of cultural suppression and near zero visibility, vibrant sexual expression and the freedom to be out and proud became staunchly defended aspects of gay and lesbian culture. Large communities of gays formed in major cities like New York and San Francisco. By 1980, around 15% of San Franciscans identified themselves as gay or lesbian. College towns like Champaign-Urbana were likewise oases for closeted youth who were living away from home for the first time. Bob Rowe grew up in Bourbonnais, Illinois in the 1960s and 70s and describes his move to the University of Illinois for college.
You go from feeling you're the only one to knowing that all of a sudden realizing you're not the only one to realizing not only you're not the only one, but you have options. That's kind of cool. It was a pretty exciting time in my life. I mean, I grew up in a really, really conservative area. So you came here and you're seeing things for the first time. I did. I mean, you're seeing other people like myself. I'm seeing gay people, obviously blatantly homosexuals. I mean, there's no denying it. And it was kind of cool. It was intriguing. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm seeing minorities. I'm seeing African Americans. I'm seeing things that I've never saw before, and it's okay. It was fun. I mean, it was coming into myself and just trying to figure out who I was. My entire life, I didn't experience this. And now I'm involved in this culture where not only is it okay if I'm queer, it's a non-issue.
The buoyant mood of the 1970s did not last long. In the early 1980s, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS, hit gay communities, first in major cities and then throughout the nation.
81, it was called gay cancer. It didn't have a name yet. It hit this town really hard mid-80s. Probably because a lot of people traveled. There was a lot of people on U of I faculty staff that were infected. It was pretty devastating. Late 80s, early 90s, I was going to a lot of funerals. I lost probably the majority of the people I knew in my 20s that I hung out with, or even my early 30s are dead. It was pretty rough. There was no money for it. It's a shameful period in our history. Government didn't do anything about research or funding research for anything for HIV. It was horrible. It was bad enough to be known as a homosexual. Then it got to be slang. Dirty slang was, you AIDS son of a bitch. It was just horrible. Don't touch me, you're going to give me AIDS, even though you may not have HIV. There was this direct correlation between homosexuality and the disease AIDS. If anything positive came out of it, would it be that some famous people ended up dying of HIV or did die of AIDS? Rock Hudson, Liberace, among other people, and that brought to the attention that Rock Hudson, he's a big stud, didn't know he was a homosexual. Unfortunately, it had to happen the way it did. Basically, there was no surviving. When you had AIDS, you died. It was just a matter of when. The cool thing in this community was people rallied, and the Gay Community AIDS Project, they bought a house. The house was able to house up to 5 people. We still own that house. But at that time, the house was where people went to die. Because basically, when you had HIV or AIDS, your family shunned you. You have nothing. You have nowhere to go. And people actually went there to die. A lot of people died there.
During the 1980s and 90s, the stigma of AIDS inextricably linked to the gay community and a lack of knowledge about the disease led to fear and trepidation. Ramona Oswald, whose mother left the house after outing her, speaks about how HIV and AIDS affected gay and lesbian image.
What had happened with my mom had kind of driven me in the closet a little bit. But when I went to college, I think the door started opening again. Unfortunately, it was at the time when HIV and AIDS were first discovered. And so my experience in college was hearing Ronald Reagan say, there's some gay disease that's killing people and they're disgusting and we don't care. So that was sort of that environment, and it felt very stigmatized, very shameful. But it wasn't until after college, and actually after living with a man and figuring my sexuality out for the last time in that relationship, that I started like going to gay pride and really getting like, oh yeah, like this is who I am. This is the community I belong to. This is the world that I want to be in.
The gay community, as a rule, was never a very united force. It was very segmented. I mean, you had drag queens, you had lesbians, you had leather queens. I mean, they were never really unified. There was no reason to be unified. Nothing really brought them together. Then there was a group called ACT UP, and that pretty much really solidified the gay community. And it was all about getting action, bringing attention to HIV, AIDS, getting public attention. And the big campaign that really worked was their campaign was Silence Equals Death, and they weren't going to shut up. And that was a huge campaign in the late 80s.
The AIDS epidemic forced many people to consider what mattered most to them.
Homosexuality, especially in men, never really had any role models of relationships. I mean, you dated and you do things like this. HIV AIDS changed that a lot. People started becoming more monogamous, more long-term relationships came out of it.
AIDS, as a disruptive and deadly disease, brought hospitals to the forefront of gay people's lives. Confronted with discriminatory hospital visitation policies and issues of post-mortem benefits, some people who had never considered marriage began to realize that there were advantages attached to formally sanctioned relationships. Bob Rowe speaks about informal wedding ceremonies in the 80s and 90s.
There's always been celebrations. Back in my early years, we called them commitment ceremonies. They weren't legally binding, but it was still a public acknowledgement of our commitment to each other.
It was an amazing experience to have that sort of public declaration of commitment to each other. And we did not commit to till death do you part. We committed to as long as we both want this to work, we will work on it and make it happen. And I feel like that was the right commitment to make because it forces you to always be intentional about your life.
As meaningful as commitment ceremonies were, they had no legal standing. Same-sex couples could not formalize their relationship in a way that conventional society accepted, and thus their partnerships were often not considered legitimate. In some circumstances, this lack of recognition was particularly consequential and distressing. Lynn Sprout, who is married to Kathy Spiegel, speaks about fighting to have a previous same-sex relationship recognized in the wake of her then-partner's serious illness.
Now, I was forced to come out. My partner was very, very sick, and I had to take her down to St. Louis to Barnes Hospital once a month. So at work, I was a manager of the pediatric department in the hospital, and so once a month, I would ask for a vacation day, and I would take her to St. Louis. And when I came home and I went back to work, I started hearing rumors that they were going to fire me because I didn't seem to have my head and my job 100%, and so I didn't know what to do. Now, at the time, there was a person on the medical floor whose husband was dying of cancer. They'd been together for 25 years. And they bent over backwards to help her. This was her world. They should have helped her. And they did. You know, if you can't make it to this meeting, don't worry about it. If you need to stay off, don't worry about it. You know, they did everything for her. I got a 90-day probationary period. I really struggled at work, but I thought I was going to get to keep my job. But then the kids called me one day and said, she's worse. So I called them one day and I said, I got to have another day. She's really gotten bad, and I am so scared. And they said, if you're not to work by Thursday, we're going to fire you. She died on Thursday. I had to fight for my rights, so I did. I sued them. They didn't think I could, but the city of Urbana has an ordinance saying that you cannot discriminate against anyone, you know, because of their race, their religion, you know, color, and because of their sexual orientation. And that had gone in 1978. This was 2001 that I did this, and I used that ordinance, and I sued them. And it took me 3 years, but at the end of 3 years, I won.
As the AIDS epidemic raised awareness of the rights of same-sex couples, the movement for marriage equality gradually gathered steam. In 1993, Hawaii's Supreme Court ruled that the state's ban on same-sex marriage appeared to be unconstitutional and ordered the state to prove a compelling state interest in keeping it. Elsewhere, in response to this decision, a slew of explicit state bans on same-sex marriage were passed. In 1996, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, explicitly defined marriage as between a man and a woman. This meant that no relationship other than a legally sanctioned heterosexual marriage would be recognized as a grounds for receiving federal benefits, including tax breaks or eligibility for permanent residence. Also in 1996, the state of Illinois banned same-sex marriage. In 2000, Vermont began granting civil unions, a legal alternative to marriage that offered similar but not identical rights for same-sex or heterosexual couples. Over the next several years, lobbying, activism, and civil disobedience won the legalization of civil unions in six states, including Illinois. Becky Sheridan discusses some of the rights that she and her partner, Janice Himes, acquired through their civil union.
Because of having our civil union, we're now considered an immediate family, so we don't have to have special legal papers to visit the other person while they're in the hospital. Although when we travel and go to some of the southern states, our attorney told us to carry our civil union license just in case the other person might not be allowed to go into the hospital room or ICU. So we carry our license in our glove compartment. I don't know how many married couples carry their marriage license around, but they don't have to.
Starting in 2004 with Massachusetts, a handful of states began legalizing same-sex marriage. Some same-sex couples went out of their way to get married in those states as soon as that possibility existed. However, these unions were still not recognized on the federal level due to DOMA, nor in most other states. Consider the perspective of Tim Temple and Jerry Carden, who, early on, traveled to Massachusetts to get married.
Like everybody else, and we can appreciate now having those same benefits as being married. You don't think about all those different benefits, you know, when they're just given to you and you don't have any work to get them by getting married. There are 1,100 different rights
that marriage affords,
that marriage gives you automatically. When we started out, I mean, we had to do separate tax forms. Sometimes that was more expensive than if you were filing together. There's always the issue of whether we would be able to see each other in the hospital if somebody got sick.
Making the decisions, you know, the end of life decisions with living wills and power of attorney, that kind of thing.
In 2007, on the 40th anniversary of the Loving versus Virginia decision, Mildred Loving commented, "I believe all Americans, no matter their race, no matter their sex, no matter their sexual orientation, should have the same freedom to marry. Government has no business imposing some people's religious beliefs over others, especially if it denies people's civil rights." From 2006 to 2010, even as Massachusetts and other states created domestic partnership laws, civil union laws, and legalized marriage for same-sex couples, still other states continued to pass constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage. Federal law came into the discussion on July 8, 2010, when District Court Judge Joseph Taro ruled that Section 3 of DOMA, which banned same-sex marriage, was unconstitutional. 1 month later, the District Court of Northern California ruled that Proposition 8, a ban on same-sex marriage in that state, was also unconstitutional. In light of these events, President Obama's administration announced in 2011 that it would no longer defend DOMA. Following the ruling on Proposition 8, in case after case, federal courts found DOMA unconstitutional. On December 7, 2012, the federal Supreme Court declared that it would hear arguments regarding same-sex marriage. In June 2013, in Windsor versus the United States, the Supreme Court ruled that key parts of DOMA were unconstitutional. This decision accelerated the campaign for marriage equality, and in Illinois, further ignited the efforts of activist groups such as Illinois Unites for Marriage and Equality Illinois. Their struggles were validated on November 20, 2013, when Illinois became the 16th state to legalize same-sex marriage.
With the Supreme Court decision in June of 2013 striking down DOMA, that covered us from the federal perspective, which is really what matters to me anyway, from the standpoint of
protection.
Protection from, you know, IRS being able to file taxes together. Tim's now at the age where he could start Social Security, and the fact that we can apply for that together and have shared benefits.
Pamela Fooey, who served as a visiting assistant professor of law at the University of Illinois, observed developments that came along with these legal milestones.
The narrative of what it means to be homosexual has changed drastically in essentially, I would say, 10 years. It's no longer you can pray the gay away, which was actually a legitimate thing. You no longer can legitimately stand up in court and say growing up with two mommies is detrimental to your children.
The push for marriage equality continued. At the beginning of 2014, 16 states had legalized same-sex marriage. By June 2015, that number had risen to 37 states. Yet in the rest of the country, the rights and responsibilities that come with legal marriage were off-limits to same-sex couples, and many felt that a comprehensive decision was needed. On June 26, 2015, exactly 2 years after its decision in Windsor versus the United States, the Supreme Court ruled in Obergefell versus Hodges that all remaining state bans on same-sex marriage were unconstitutional. This landmark decision legalized same-sex marriage for the entire nation, requiring every state to grant marriage licenses to all couples and to recognize all marriage licenses issued by any other state. Following news of the ruling, President Barack Obama delivered a speech commending the majority's decision.
We are a people who believe that every single child is entitled to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. There's so much more work to be done to extend the full promise of America to every American. But today we can say, in no uncertain terms, that we've made our union a little more perfect. That's the consequence of a decision from the Supreme Court, but more importantly, it is a consequence of the countless small acts of courage of millions of people across decades who stood up, who came out, who talked to parents, parents who loved their children no matter what. Folks who were willing to endure bullying and taunts and stayed strong and came to believe in themselves and who they were. And slowly made an entire country realize that love is love.
The legalization of same-sex marriage across the United States could not have occurred without a remarkable shift in attitudes among the general public. In 1996, a Gallup poll found that a little over a fourth of Americans supported same-sex marriage. Almost two decades later, in 2015, more than half of those polled came out in favor of marriage equality. Nonetheless, just as with interracial marriage, the struggle for full acceptance and for protection from discrimination continues, even after legal equality has been established. For same-sex and interracial couples like Megan and Peggy Paisley, the unabashed curiosity of strangers who see them together in public is still something they have to deal with. As Megan wonders,
are they staring because they're like, oh, look how cute they are? Or are they staring because they think that we're a black man and a white woman? Are they staring because they can tell we're lesbians and that's not okay? You know what I mean? There's a lot of sort of factors about why, and we won't know unless they come up to us and say something, which we hope they don't, unless it's that they think we're cute.
Even as the right to marry has been established, further obstacles to full civil rights remain. As of June 2015, only 19 states have anti-discrimination laws that protect against unfair treatment on the basis of sexual orientation or gender expression in housing and employment. Of these 19 states, only 17 currently have legislation that protects individuals who identify as LGBT from harassment or discrimination in public spaces. Such inequities call for further advocacy and education. Part of the challenge is to get people to see these issues as matters of basic civil rights. Reflecting on the intent of laws proposed in some states to protect the so-called religious freedom of business owners who are opposed to same-sex marriages, Kathleen Robbins observes.
The same arguments that were used against service to blacks are now used against LGBT people. I've struggled to figure out why somebody else's happiness threatens somebody else's marriage. Jay Leno said it best, they should have the same right to be miserable as I do. I mean, how does that impact somebody else's life? Civil marriage is a civil right. You can get married without ever setting foot in a church at all, but you can't get married without a state-issued marriage license. If people choose to have it reflect their religion, I think it's great. And particularly with children, I think the special emphasis we accord marriage in our society, particular rights of survivorship, that type of thing, are really critical for a family, and to deny that, that a family only has to be one specific way, seems very prejudicial to me.
Karen Bush, a campus minister at a United Church of Christ congregation in Champaign, echoes Kathleen Robbins' sentiments.
To me, it has just seemed insane that it has been part of the culture of our country and the world for a majority to say, I'm uncomfortable with you having love, so I expect you to make me more comfortable so you be celibate.
In some situations, religious teachings can breed prejudice against people identifying as LGBT. This was a concern for Lori and Leslie Miller Nicholson as they looked for a church where they would feel welcome.
We go to the Unitarian Universalist Church in Urbana on Green Street, and I think part of coming to terms with being gay for me was shunning my religion, the religion I was brought up in, which I felt like was a hypocritical religion, you're going to be damned to hell religion. And so I stepped away from organized religion for many, many, many years. And it wasn't until after 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. That we as a couple felt like we needed a religious community. And so our idea was to kind of do the Baskin-Robbins of religions and just to sample the 32 flavors in town. We happened to go to the Unitarian Universalist Church first, and that was the end of that. We didn't sample anymore. And it's never that I lost faith in God. I think I lost faith in organized religion.
Over time, some faith communities have made it a central part of their mission to be welcoming of all people, regardless of sexual orientation or gender expression. As Leah Roberts Mosser, pastor of the Community United Church of Christ, explains,
being an ally means leveraging the power that I possess in the world in favor of people who are marginalized. And we still live in a country where gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people are marginalized. So I will do everything within my power to change that.
In the past, visibility of LGBT people was low. As long as heterosexuality was the unquestioned norm, groups and individuals had to take chances and rally together if they were to acknowledge their sexual orientation with pride. Yet at this point, it seems that many people simply want general acceptance, not special recognition. As Becky Sheridan observed,
it would be so nice if they could think about it as not same-sex relationship. If they could just think of it as a relationship. Do people talk about their heterosexual partner? Are you in a same-sex or are you in an opposite-sex relationship? Nobody gets asked that other than people that are gay or lesbian. So I would like to get rid of the same-sex relationship wording or heterosexual or homosexual. I don't think it really matters because we're all the same.
Kathy Spiegel echoes Becky's sentiments.
Sexual orientation is just like having a freckle on your nose. It's just part of who you are. And I think it's important for younger people to understand that it's just a part of the way I was created. It has nothing to do with me as a person. It doesn't make me bad, good, or indifferent. It's just me.
Attitudes and practices surrounding fundamental relationships continue to change. Yet the wedding remains a quintessential symbol of the union between two people. Casey George Jackson reflects on the purposes of a wedding.
I think it's just a time to celebrate. A lot of it is very symbolic, like the process is very symbolic, but I think it's a time for family and friends to come together and just to celebrate the couple and their relationship and what I think is the potential for their future. You know, time to toast them and talk about how their relationship has grown, but also to talk about what they're going to do in the future and have good wishes for them in the future.
Bob Rowe recounts the joy of the day when he and his partner Greg were married.
It was amazing. It was unbelievable. Greg's mom and dad were there. My mom and dad were there. My sister made it down. My one nephew made it. All Greg's brothers and sister, except for his sister in Switzerland, made it. His uncles, aunts. His family had turned out. I had friends who flew in from California, friends who flew in from Key West. It was beautiful. It was the happiest day of my life. It was amazing.
Megan Paisley appreciated the chance to add personal touches to the celebration when she and Peggy were married.
I would say there were things that were uniquely us. It was sort of a mix of traditional and stuff that was very meaningful to us. We exchanged rings. Our close friends were part of the ceremony. I mean, things like that. But we did things that were us, like we did a tree planting ceremony as a symbolic act, but now we have the tree. It was very us. We wanted it to be just a reflection of us and how we feel about each other.
For many couples, the presence of family and friends is deeply significant. When officiating in weddings, Pastor Leah Roberts Mosser makes a point of calling on those in attendance.
After the couple has exchanged vows and they've said I do to each other, then I turn around to the congregation and I say, these aren't the only two people who are going to make promises to each other today. You are going to make promises to them as well, because they are not going to be able to get through this life on their own. They need you and they need your support. Do you offer your love, support, and care to, and then I name the people's names. If so, please say, I do. And they all say, I do. And to watch the couple as they hear everybody in the room affirm them, gay, straight, doesn't matter. To have all of your family and friends say, we will support you no matter what life brings, and especially for gay couples. Maybe there are some people in the room who really wonder whether or not they can do that. To have that moment, it's a big deal, and it matters. It really matters.
Marriages and families are as complex and colorful as the world we live in. But in each and every marriage, we can find the values that support meaningful relationships.
I've seen a bunch of change. I mean, I've seen change broadly in the world, but in terms of my family and my circle, I don't know that marriage was really talked. I mean, it was talked about in the sense of, like, people get married and you should wait for marriage to do certain things. I would say the main change is that it was talked about in a very heterosexual way growing up, and he and she and husband and wife. And now I hear a lot more partner and spouse. The language would be the biggest thing I think that I've seen, is being mindful about what words are used.
And there's still that very heteronormative type of place that happens on a broader kind of scale. You know, you still see that a lot of places. But I think that it's starting to get better in the sense that it's becoming more diverse.
We're just like everybody else, and we have the same struggles and the same arguments and the same bills and the same as everybody else. We do everything just like everybody else does.
Marriage is not a race, it's a marathon, yeah. You know, and it's something that you're doing every day of your life.
What aspects of marriage do you believe are most important for a couple?
Respect.
Mm-hmm. Trust.
Mm-hmm. This takes a while to come to, letting the other person be the person that they are, and not trying to change that person, which is part of respect.
Honest communication.
Yeah. And then with parenting, always respecting the other person's parenting and backing that person up. Mm-hmm. Which is something we've managed to do very well.
And listening.
To each other and the children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think those are the biggies.
Those were some of the biggies.
You have to still date and you have to laugh.
Yeah, passion helps.
You have to laugh a lot.
The reality is the good, strong relationships take work. They take continual work and continual commitment. That has nothing to do whether you're gay or whether you're straight. The thing until just recently is there's been so much pressure on LGBT couples because of that. What are the neighbors going to say? How are my kids? And it's only just been in the last 5 years that that's really changed and begun to normalize. People can get married because they love each other. People make a commitment to each other and want to spend their lives together. And are willing to work at that. And that's not a straight or gay issue. That's a life and love issue. Can't really stand on my feet. Take a look at yourself. In the mirror and cry. What about your daddy? I have spent all my years in believing you. But I just can't get no relief. Lord, somebody.
We hope you enjoyed The Pursuit of Happiness, The Struggle for Marriage Equality from the 1950s to 2015. The program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Alice Hu, Emma Andreshkova, Nafisa Sayed, Simone Gewirth, and Vinay Koshi, with help from Priya Bhatt, Callie Bruce, Evan Dinkowitz, Zina Dolan, Catherine Delarude, Linus Urbach, Sankhya Hirani, Carissa Hu, Keisha Patel, Alyssa Rauschenberger, Rima Rebi, Ellen Rispoli, Hadley Shapland, Arielle Summit, Katie Tender, and Maggie Tewksbury. Interviews were conducted by the Uni High Class of 2017 and members of the production team. Stories were contributed by Karen Bush, Pamela Fui, Casey George Jackson, Becky Lewis, Ramona Oswald, Leah Roberts Mosser, Kathleen Robbins, Bob Rowe, Leslie and Lori Miller Nicholson, Barkley and Howard Milton, Martha and Tom Moore, Diana Black and Joe Omoosagie, Megan and Peggy Paisley, Janice Himes and Becky Sheridan, Kathy Spiegel and Lynn Sprout, Jerry Carden and Timothy Temple, Harold Alston and Nancy Yeagle. The program was directed by Dave Dickey of Illinois Public Media and University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford. For more information on our project, please visit our website at illinoisyouthmedia.org.